Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to another Rahalastapur Book Club. I am delighted to be joined by Sarah Pascoe, who has written her first novel, which is called Weirdo. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. Good. I'm all right. I'm good. Coping. Yeah. That's my honest answer.
we were talking about before. It's very tough. Two young kids, very tough time, but still working very hard, and you obviously wrote this book, I presume, when you had one kid, so you're still managing to get the work done, which is very impressive.
I was one of those stupid people, especially because I was 40, and I sort of thought, you know, if I've coped with everything so far, how hard can a baby be? and I thought I'll have all of this rest time when I have the baby. So I left myself about 3 or 4 months for the first draft. I thought, because the baby will be sleeping all the time, right? And I wouldn't listen when people said, this is a terrible idea. give them back the advance. I was like, no, this is completely doable. And I mean, it is doable, but I wouldn't recommend that to any other new parents.
Yeah, it's a tough thing writing a novel anyway. I remember when Phoebe was born, like the first 2 or 3 days, I'd be lying in bed and she'd fall asleep, and I'd have my computer and I'd tap away, and I thought, this could work out. This could be this could be fine. And then I quickly realised that those days were largely gone. But there we go. We won't talk about that. So look, it's interesting. You've obviously had books out before, which were sort of factual books about big subjects, animals and sex, power, money. That was just one book with the sex, power, money. Those are three pretty big subjects to cover it, even in three books. So what has drawn you to write a novel?
I always wanted to be a novelist, Richard. Very arrogantly. No, not arrogantly. It was the opposite of arrogance. Was it opposite of arrogance? It's very humble of me. So when I was young, I had this sort of vision for a life which would encompass the entertainment industry. I wanted to be an actor rather than a comedian, but I was going to allow myself, my 20s and 30s, to selfishly be a performer And then I would segue into novelist in my 40s. And then in my 50s, then I was going to start my generativity phase, which was charity work, politics, setting up a local drama group. Great. And it was just an odd coincidence that I did write my first novel in my 40s. But I definitely wanted to wait until I'd read so much that I could at least know a bad novel when I saw one. So that if I was writing a terrible novel, I could just stop and go, don't. The world doesn't need this.
Yes. I mean, but it's hard to judge one's own writing, I think, isn't it? It is, you know, that's whenever I've started to try and write anything like this, and I've always got like a chapter or two in and then given up.
Yes.
It's so hard to know whether it, you know, because it's finding your voice. It's that thing of not writing as if you're writing a novel, which I have to say, I think you've done, but it's, you look back and you go, oh, I'm sort of writing in a highfalutin fashion.
Yes, I've definitely, I had lots of false starts as well, Richard.
Yeah.
The difference with this one is that the characters just started to do things by themselves, which was completely off my plan.
Right.
So when you pitch a novel, you do have to say to them, this will happen, this will happen, this is the ending. And then about three chapters in, my characters were doing other stuff. And I was like, guys, I've promised Faber, you're going over there. And they were like, sorry. And that was the difference, is that it sort of carried itself along in a way the other ones hadn't, where I'd really been like, what colour, what smell would there be? Like asking myself all these sort of writer prompts. And with this one, the world knew itself much better.
Yeah, that's great. That's really interesting. And I think, you know, you do know that, you know, I've experienced that writing scripts where I like to write like a sitcom script without knowing what's going to happen. And it's great when the characters sort of know themselves and you discover, you know, after they've discovered. And so that, I think that's always a really good sign.
Yeah.
How would you describe this book? Because I don't want to take over and say what I think. What would you, how do you, when people say, what's the book about? What is your response?
What's the book about is the hardest question.
Yes.
Because actually, if I describe this book, it sounds very simple and quite boring. Because I, you know, it's about a girl who works in a pub. It's about a girl in Essex who works in a pub. It's about a girl from Essex who works in a pub and is obsessed with a guy she used to work with on the buses. It's about a very paranoid girl from Essex who works in a pub, and she's got a miserable boyfriend and she thinks she'll be happy with someone else, I guess, is the story.
Yeah. But it's sort of, I mean, because it's about the human condition, and it's about, I mean, it's obviously an internal monologue.
That's true.
I suppose you would call it this book, and it's, so it really is sort of all of her thoughts, both some lucid and a lot of them crazy, and a lot of them, I mean, let's not say crazy, but you know what I mean.
Oh, I think we can say crazy. We're the right generation to not have the right words. The thing is, I wanted to get as deep into someone's mind as possible.
Yeah.
Because the reason I love stand-up is I feel like quite often when I'm watching a stand-up, I'm seeing a microphone, not in front of their mouth, but like into the brain. Like someone, especially if someone's trying new stuff and spouting, I feel like, oh, come on, say all the mad stuff we think. And I wanted to go really deep. And so it had to be first-person narration. Because sometimes I get frustrated when a novelist will tell me, and then the character went over there. And I'm like, but why? Why did they go over there? I wanted you to always know. And I wanted to see all the false thoughts, all the things that you don't say out loud or that you wouldn't know would be influencing behaviour. And all the things that, and I do think this is very common, if not universal, the thoughts you would never say out loud to anyone, even people you're in intimate relationships with. And you don't even notice them sometimes and how crazy they are, because you're just used to this background babble.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to explore that. And then the actions of the character and the story then sort of took, they had their own path afterwards. But really, I just wanted to know what she was thinking wherever she was.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's interesting because, of course, you know, I think everyone will have something like this internal monologue. So she's not a very likeable character, yeah. But I don't think anyone would be likeable if you wrote down everything they thought. I think that most people would be less likeable than this. But also, I think it makes so I identify with a lot of it, certainly from my own dating days, my own insecurity, my own paranoia, and a lot of the same things that I think everyone thinks, but we'll get into some of those later. But also, I think it's interesting to see, to read somebody else doing it and think, oh God, you know, when you were dating and that person said they liked you and wanted to have sex with you, maybe inside their head they were thinking all the stuff that this girl's thinking. And then you realize how complicated it is, because, you know, people present one face, and then, I mean, there's an incredible, awful sex scene in it that goes on for a very, very long time. With their thoughts. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant piece of writing and it's amazing. But then you go, oh my God. I suppose I've been in that situation when you're not really into what's going on. You're thinking about other things and you're thinking terrible stuff. But, I think just seeing somebody else write it all down, because she thinks she's the only one, I guess, that's like this as well. But we're all kind of like this as well, so yes. It's reassuring but also terrifying to see somebody write down all the things that you think yourself, I suppose.
I really wish there was a way out of those sexual situations. I think we're having a really good conversation culturally about, you know, enthusiastic consent and boundaries and advocating for ourselves, but there's a level below that where you can really like someone and want to have sex with them and then have terrible sex that you don't stop.
And it actually, Richard, that
awful stuck feeling, as in that one where, okay, I've started it, so we'll just have to get through it.
Yeah.
But being in your own head reminds me of a bad gig, because it's exactly the same when you're performing to the audience and it should be working, but it's not. And there's no way out. You just have to do your next joke and do your next joke. And those gigs are so soul destroying, because the odd thing is the robotic, like, I've committed. So now here we go until the closer. And it's such an odd thing that there isn't like a flag you can wave of like, you're not enjoying this, I'm not enjoying this. How do we break out of it? We have all of these social contracts, you know, we've agreed now, we're both naked, so this is what we're doing. There's no way out.
And, you know, I think it's very timely as well, because I think obviously like a lot of these, the kind of more paranoid thoughts are sort of coming out in the discussions of major events, you know, and people are paranoid and people are voicing their paranoias and saying the Earth's flat, or that, you know, the government's trying to make 15-minute cities, or that there's vaccines aren't trying to poison you, and that's coming out. And these thoughts that she has, which they're not those sort of political thoughts, but they are those, you know, everyone in the world is a robot kind of thoughts that I think we sort of all have as kids. The quantum leap thing, which is there's a couple of things that have come up in Rallis, but that are in this, which is quite, I'm obsessed with the idea of quantum leap. I like to pretend. Yeah. Every now, one of my girlfriends managed to work out that I was pretending I just quantum leaped into my own body without me saying, oh boy, I think, as well. So it was quite impressive. I was looking around and she'd go, you could be. And I was pretending. But I would, you know, that idea is fascinating. The caterpillar dissolving and turning into a butterfly.
Oh, yes.
That is something that I think, was it Jos Norris? I can't remember who brought it up, but it was. But that's a fascinating idea, and that's explored. But this protagonist is sort of exploring these ideas in a pseudo intellectual way. She's definitely smart, but she's sort of pretentious, trying to be pretentiously smart sometimes, and is stupid sometimes.
I think she's normal. I really wanted her to have a normal person's interest in things, a normal person's interest in books, for instance, as in you've read a few, so you don't realize how ignorant you are, but the stuff that you do know about makes you feel clever, and you create your own narrative, like exactly what you're saying about the conspiracy theorists. We don't doubt our own narratives. Maybe we don't doubt them as much as we used to. It's like, well, I feel that's true, so it's truth, and my feeling is the evidence of it, you know. I've never seen a round world. It doesn't make any sense to me. So that's the facts of this. And yeah, that when I was at university, we because I did an English degree, I got obsessed with unreliable narrators because I loved that a good writer could let the reader know what's true while the character was telling them something else. And the book that I love that does it so well is Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
In Catcher in the Rye, he'll tell you a story about a teacher he thought was creepy, but you're listening and you can hear that the teacher was actually being very caring about a boy who was really struggling with adolescence. And so you'd get these two narratives at once. And it always felt very wise. It felt, and so that's what I wanted to do with Sophie. I did need her to be idiotic so that I could tell the reader two things. She thinks this because of this, but you know, of course, this because of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that definitely works. And it is, you know, and it's nice. It is a journey for her. And there is, you know, there is hope for her, I think, at the end. I think she sort of, you know, she, without giving anything away, she sort of, you know, ends up in a place where you feel like she can move forwards, I think.
Yes. Definitely. I think that's what happens for lots of young people. It definitely happened for me. If you'd asked me in my late 20s, would I ever be happy? I would have told you, no, I'm just not built that way. Unless I'm on drugs, I'm going to be miserable. And I don't feel that way now. And I feel like there's a lot that, you're 29 to 39, there's a huge amount of learning possible, a huge amount of self-forgiveness, understanding your own parents. It's the exact opposite to adolescence, with a lot less drama and a lot more time to process things as a proper adult. And they can come with that, a real second phase of life where you go, oh, okay, that is the past now. These are stuff that happened, but doesn't affect my everyday like it used to at university.
It's true. You've really got that. I know. Yeah, the family relationship is really interesting, and the way that changes, and the way that that there's not so much blame, I suppose, by the end. And you know, it is that thing you have to be content within yourself, I think, before you can really move into having somebody else properly in your life. So you know, same with me. You know, I think probably it was more like 40 by the time I got to the right place. But you know, it is you're romantic. You want to be in love, but yourself, I'm talking about, are making sure that will never happen, and probably sabotaging stuff deliberately as well. You know, or subconsciously at least. It's really interesting.
After a breakup once, Richard, Lou Sanders sent me to a crystals guy, a Reiki and crystals, and I'm not a Reiki and crystals guy, but. No. After a breakup is a really good time to just say yes to everything, really, isn't it? So I went to see a guy called Philip, and it was perfect, because actually what he said to me was pain is attracted to pain. So many relationships, you're getting together with someone, and what you're feeling is attraction, is how bad you're going to be for each other because of the pain you're bringing into the relationship. And that's such a sensible way to look at it. When you look back at lots of early relationships, you can really see, okay, they had issues with that and I had issues with that. And together we were, you know, eventually not very nice to each other, or it was quite detrimental. So I do think, and I think when you tell redemption stories, it is tempting to go, and then they fell in love, or then they had a baby. And as someone who's recently done both of those things, I don't think they're happy endings. I think there's something much calmer, much less dramatic than a wedding fanfare, which is just someone being a bit like just letting go of some of the past and sitting with themselves a bit more. And that to me feels like this huge achievement, but we would never see it celebrated because it's too boring.
It's understanding where, you know, because it's very easy to blame other people for everything in your life. It's very easy to blame your parents. It's very easy to blame ex-partners and say, oh, that was all that relation. You know, you get those things where a relationship goes wrong and you want to load all the blame on the other person. Yeah. But it's very, very, very rare that it's actually just one person is completely in the wrong.
And again, it's that narrative. Yeah. If you're describing to someone else, you know, what happened, there's a narrative where you are the hero and you were wronged, rather than, you know, the actual very complicated wondering how how the other person will describe it to their friends and what the truth is in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, in Rahulspur, I've had a couple of my ex-partners on who, you know, haven't really spoken to for a few years, and both of them had entirely different memories of why we broke up, I think, at least. So, like, entirely different. And so I'm not saying they're wrong and I'm right. They are wrong and I am right. Yeah. But I'm not saying that. But it's, you know, you obviously, you know, because memory is, you change your memory to make yourself the hero of your own story as much as anything, but within the moment and later on. But it is interesting how two people who've been through the same thing will view it in entirely differently and forget about their own culpability.
The memory is really powerful in sort of changing stuff and making us the good guy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And also we decide what someone else meant or means. So, you know, in a row, all you remember is how they made you feel, not what they actually said. So, you have completely different versions of it.
Yeah. And then, done.
Well, then we're supposed to all walk around and pretend that we're sane. That's the thing.
Yes.
Rather than going, everything is movable. There is no truth. There's just perception.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Well, that's what I love about this. I talked to Dan Schreiber about it on his podcast because I was reading it. I read it a few months ago. I've read it twice. Well, I've listened to it twice, actually, I should say. I was just listening to it when I spoke to him, and it was very into, you know, his podcast is all about, you know, more supernatural, weird things that have happened to you. And this, you know, thinking about those things, thinking about the, you know, that sort of quantum leap stuff, the kind of everyone in Australia being, you know, that somehow that's a fiction that's been, I mean, that, you know, I remember thinking that when I was a teenager, thinking, you know, how do I know I haven't just got on a plane and then it's, you know, and then when we get
it's all
set up. I mean, but imagine, how important would you be in the world for someone to
do that? It's such an arrogant thought. And the billions involved, and then all of those people going along with it just to trick you. When the film The Truman Show came out, so it was released, because it was so similar to an idea that I had been living with, which was that I was being watched and it was a TV program and everyone knew when I'd lied, everyone knew when I'd done something wrong, that I thought that they'd released the film to make me think it wasn't true, because if it was true, why would there be a film within it? And that's how I knew it was true. And that is the ultimate. This is, again, like the ego is this sort of arrogant, we are the main character. Imagine Jim Carrey signing up for a project to trick me that I wasn't in a TV show.
But, you know, again, there must be some psychological reason that we do that. I mean, obviously, we have to view ourselves as important to get through life, I suppose, but it is, you know, but it is detrimental. I think, you know, I think that film was so successful because everyone had thought of that idea, at least if they didn't think it was happening to them. I didn't think it was a particularly good exploration of it myself, but you know, I think it's, you know, that's it. But some of the stuff, and, you know, it, I don't want to get into the, oh, how much of this is you? And I know there's lots of similarities between you and the character in terms of jobs you've done and things that have happened to you. But there's things that are, so, you can't, for you to have imagined some of these things in your own head means that you've imagined the things in your head. So there, so it has to be an element. The one about the cat being like a video camera observing you that your mum's watching and then deciding that it's a boy at school has the same eyes. Is that it? So that it's he's watching you on the toilet when the cat's watching you on the toilet. That's a pretty unique and interesting one, I think, that must have come to yourself.
This is what I mean about the character sort of running off with things by themselves. Right. I wanted to give her the Truman Show thing that I was familiar with, and the idea of being a bit paranoid about a mum. And Sophie started telling me all this stuff about robot cats and Abbas at school. And I was like, okay.
But it's really good stuff, you know. And I think if you are plagued by thoughts like that, which I think everyone is, but maybe everyone isn't. Maybe some people don't think about anything. I don't know. Some people don't have an internal monologue there, so I don't know how they get on. But,
I think.
I don't know.
So peaceful.
I kind of lie and joy,
like,
I think,
like
most
Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson just being like, oh, there's a biscuit. Just lovely. No complication. No, the minute something nice has happened, questioning, does everyone think I'm a knob? Did I say an awful thing? Ruining, you know, everywhere you've ever been. Everything just going, no, it wasn't that good.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the thing is the realisation that nobody really cares as well, is it? That, so you care so much. One cares so much about those things and, you know, you're so worried about upsetting people or, I'm exactly the same. And then you realise, actually, again, that's a form of arrogance because most people are not that interested in you.
I've got two proofs that you're wrong, by the way. Okay. Number one, I used to tell myself that, you know, everyone's only good for thinking about themselves until people started bitchy WhatsApp groups where they screen grabbed what other comedians do on social media and then make fun of them. So definitely the paranoia is right. And the other
I'm not involved in any of those groups, so now I'm paranoid about that.
Well, nor am I. And so I'm paranoid. That's why we're not in them, Richard, so they can make fun of us. And then the other thing is when I very, very first went to therapy, this is like a number of years ago, in the first session I was talking about, you know, low self-worth, etc., and negative inner voices. And she was saying, but, you know, you tell yourself these horrible things about yourself. When has that ever happened to you in real life? And I had to explain Twitter to her, which was at that point more popular. And definitely if you were a woman on television, you would get a nice little flurry of just how fat and disgusting you were, as well as being very unfunny and a waste of space, etc. And as I was telling her, she was going, but surely this must be illegal. and it was so lovely describing it to a woman in her 70s who hadn't been using the internet. And she couldn't believe it was allowed. It's like, I know.
It is unbelievable. But I think, again, when you think about those people, you have to then think about what's going on in their internal monologue and why they, you know, I know it's never as bad for men and male comedians out there, but you know, you do get some of it. And I think you start thinking about why they're doing it. And often, like, when, again, Omra Halastapur on YouTube, there's a comment section, and if it's a woman or if it's an ethnic comedian, there'll be suddenly a lot more comments about why the people don't like that person. And then occasionally I'll challenge them as to why they're doing it. And just say, I'm sure you're not sexist, but it's weird the way this only happens to women. So, you know, you're contributing to that. And so you can sometimes get a little bit in there. And I think, you know, I think it is, the way I kind of got over all of that is it's just showing, they're immediately showing an internal weakness by appearing to be bothered. And it's obviously actually something about them that is making them do it. It's not actually something about it. The fact they do it to all female comedians again means it isn't you specifically. It's it's their own issue with whatever it is that only they're going to find that out. But, you know, I think that's what I like about this book. I think it makes you think about yourself. It makes you feel better about your own paranoia and weird feelings. But also I think it does put you in the to spend so much time with one person, to have to go, and it's painful sometimes and it's irritating sometimes, and she's really stupid sometimes, and yet, like you say, you know she's being stupid, so it kind of makes it kind of stronger, I suppose, but you know, it is reassuring, I think, to to know that other people feel that way and act that way. And also, I think, to be that you can then look at that person and say, oh, look, I know what you're doing wrong here. Then hopefully the people reading it might go, oh, let's turn that light on myself, which is what should happen on Twitter. The light should have to turn around, and you have to then explain why you feel it this way.
I really wanted to spend time with like why we stay so long in uncomfortable relationships, like why when neither person is clearly happy.
Yeah,
and you both know that, but you're still there. That's again something that's so common. And when you're out of an unhappy relationship, you think, why did it take us so long? And I don't know the answer to that question.
I think it is just that, you know, I had that a lot. Like, and I had relationships and I kind of secretly hoped the other person would die in order, you know, not really, but there was a part of me, just because then I could get out of it, and I couldn't see the way out of it.
Without that.
And that's just crazy. And you go, the way out is just go, I'm not happy. We have to end this. Neither of us are happy. Why are we carrying on with this? You know, and obviously there's an element with relationships where you have to try and ride through the unhappiness, which again, I suppose, is a part of having a mature relationship, that you have to take the rough with the smooth a little bit. But it's sort of extraordinary. You know, I was trying to come up with a joke about that, about saying, you know, in the past, I used to want to get out of a relationship. When I want to get a relationship, I wish the other person would die. Now I've finally found my wife. I'm in a relationship and I'm much more mature. Now when I'm unhappy, I wish that I would die to get out of a relationship. So, which I think, again, there's an element of truth in it. But it's, you know, it's one of those crazy thoughts, obviously, but it equally does show that weakness. And yeah, the protagonist here is, you know, is really in hanging on to stuff that she doesn't need to hang on to, with a guy who really isn't interested in anyone but himself.
His borderline incel. I've actually, rather than the really hardcore guys, I'm really interested in the men who would pass socially, but actually, if you get down to it, I've got some really like dark opinions, or a lot of rage that is suppressed. So there's a thing now where most people have the correct language to use, so you can pass for being quite a, you know, a feminist, an anti-racist, you know, being quite right on, woke, actually, I guess that's the word. You can pass for that until someone asks you a couple more questions and the anger's still there. And you meet those people and you get this unsettling feeling of like, oh, I don't think you think women are human beings, but you're not saying it explicitly. And I think those people are interesting, how they can sort of, they're hiding, but they're still there like spiders in the corner. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, he's awful. But yeah, again, there's an element of selfishness, I guess. Again, once you go into internal monologues, I think there's an element where people are battling with those ideas, you know, because we've all, I guess, even people who are woke and right on, and certainly anyone of our age who is, will have had to have some internal battles along the way. And have changed their mind about things. And I certainly, compared to the 15-year-old me, I feel quite differently about women and all of those, you know, all the things that would have confused and upset me. And, you know, and that's part of the journey. But yeah, it is, you know, you're definitely right that there's, I mean, that's almost the problem, is that a lot of men think the men who are being feminist or claiming to be feminist are just doing it in the hope that women will sleep with them or whatever. Which, you know, and some of them are, so that's the
problem. Not even women will sleep with them, just the whole like, oh, I think thou doth protest too much. Like when someone sort of, you know, gets on the bus and goes, I think women are the same as men and should have equal opportunities. Like, you are shouting about that to such an extent. I know you don't really think that's true.
Well, you know, human beings, as we see in this book, are very complex, and it is, you know, I'm really glad to have gone back to it, because we were going to do the interview before Christmas, and I'd read the book a few months before that, so I thought, well, I better re-familiarise myself with it, make sure I've got it also. But it was really nice. I don't hardly ever do that, go back and go for a book a second time, certainly in that quicker time period. And it was really interesting to do that. But it was one of those things, when I was reading it, like when I ended up talking to Dan about it, it was just that it really permeates, and you think about the themes and you think about the ideas in it, and it's you do want to know what's going to happen. You do want to know what to get out of it. I really like the sister character. Yeah. And there's a sort of lovely, I mean, I thought this is a bit too comedic. Mm. But then I sort of saw very, very similar things online. Oh. where she's got a wedding list. And
oh, everything on that wedding list is something I've seen in real life.
Really? Yeah.
Yes. It's the bit I do at book readings, because I say to people, I've seen all of these, or one of my either they've come to me or it's gone to a friend. Every single thing. The thing about what dress shops you're not allowed to go to, that's real. Yeah. Right. The thing about not inviting plus ones because they don't like everyone's boyfriend and girlfriend, that's real.
Wow.
Yeah. The thing about we don't want children to come in case they fall in the lake and ruin the day, that's real.
It's incredible. It's very, very funny. And it's the lack of self-awareness, or I suppose the not caring how you look. Yeah. But it is very much a wedding thing. You think, again, I suppose a wedding is all of this put into one day, isn't it? It's a day where you're allowed to say, this is my day. So finally, I'm allowed to behave in the way that I would behave every day if I was the king of the world.
Well, that's it. Yeah, everyone gets to be a dictator about their own wedding. And I guess... I mean, it's very odd. So I got married without having a wedding. So I'm not a hypocrite here. I understand wanting to marry someone, and that can mean something, that commitment. But the actual wedding day, and maybe it's because I'm a performer for my job. So the idea of hundreds of people being together looking at me, it's like, Monday to Saturday. it doesn't feel special. It doesn't make me... I don't need to be a dictator there. I'm a dictator at work, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I'm the only one talking for over an hour. I'm obsessed with what happens to people and what happened actually to my own sisters. I didn't base Dana on either of my sisters or on their weddings, because I'm not allowed to talk about my family anymore, which is also part of the reason I'm now writing fiction. but I could have done, because it is, I don't like the word bridezilla, because I think it happens to men just as much. But the idea that something about that day is supposed to signify the rest of your life and how happy you will be or not, or that there's some kind of magic in it, that if you can get it right, you're blessed now, you're safe. You've made a spell. And the amount of money that people spend that don't have any money. That's what I noticed. With my family, is that you've got people who are earning under 20 grand a year who are planning weddings that cost more than that.
Yeah.
And the wedding industry itself, everything's so expensive. I've got to sound like a bitter old woman. but really, just what does it matter? If someone planned a 30th birthday party that cost £16,000, you'd go, that you don't need to spend all that money to have a nice time.
No, I suppose it's weird as well, because in the old days, the parents would have paid for the wedding. It wouldn't have been as expensive as they are getting, but they would have paid for it, because people would be 19 and just starting their life or whatever.
Yeah.
And now most of us are getting married in our 30s, where we're expected to pay for it, but you can't go, I can't really afford to do this. I mean, we tried to do it. We did it. We were just going to have a room by the pub, and then we did it. It sort of did expand a little, but not that much. But we managed to. It was actually cheaper to do it in a hotel. But it got more expensive. But Katie just went and bought a second-hand dress in the sales from just a regular white dress, not like a wedding dress.
Yeah.
And that's how we started. So we spent like £150 on the wedding dress.
I think that kind of thing's so positive, because that's how you stay sane. It's a dress I'm going to wear once, and you've got a very attractive wife. She's going to look lovely in a £150 dress. She doesn't need to spend.
But this is all really interesting stuff. And we'll leave the content of the book away, although. Let's talk about, those ideas of there being no free will is a little runny. running thing through Hattie, which is a terrifying thing that we all, again, will think at some point, or will read some scientific paper that says we have no free will. That's quite interesting.
They're proving it more and more.
Yeah.
And I talked to Dan Schreiber about it when I did his podcast, which is after you, because it was before a gig. This is the first time I heard it. And Tim Minchin said to me, just, you know, as I was about to go on, you know, there's no free will. And I'd only just met him, and he's a very famous, a comic that I respected so much. I was like, so excuse me? There definitely is. And he was like, no, there isn't. And he recommended me a book. And I guess it just lodged in my head that this is the kind of thing that men say. Just sort of women who were previously fine with thinking there was free will. It's no, there's not. And then it's an interesting subject, because it's one of those things that is probably true, but not knowing it doesn't affect your life, really. Yeah. I don't think it makes your life better to think, oh, my brain is making decisions that I'm not in charge of. I think that's where you'd start to go. And that's when I started to actually unravel.
Yeah. With all these things, the thing that I sort of think might well be true is that we live in a simulation, because it feels, it feels as likely as not. And, I also sort of feel just the chances of being alive are so small, but the chances of being alive now at this time and being in such a lucky position and, to live at this point in human history is so impossible that you sort of feel, is it real? But it does, if we are, and I think Robin Hood said this in his book, if we do live in a simulation, there's nothing we can do about it. And you just have to carry on living your life as if you don't live in a simulation. It's a pretty good simulation if it is
a simulation. That's essentially what all philosophy books should end with. But anyway, life's too short not to take a lot of this for granted. good luck. It definitely is. It's something you can't get too frustrated about, especially if you're the lay person not doing the experiments. You have to go like, oh, spooky.
Yeah.
Smoke your imaginary doobie and and go, but I'm going to carry on like it's real, actually.
Yeah. But the free will thing, it's still you. It's just it's just not the conscious. You know, it's just you. What you see as yourself is the bit that's thinking and the bit that feels like you. But it's still, and unless you think we are being controlled by a god or an alien of something, it's still you making those decisions. You just don't realize why you've made them.
So you're just a computer that a lot of information's been input, and that's your conditioning, which affects your decisions, but not in a way that you consciously might be aware of. It's fun to think about. And then I go, I'm so glad I'm not a student anymore. And that thing though about the craziness of existing at all, the chances of it and how lucky a lot of us feel to be alive now. It's very odd. I don't know if you had this about having children, because we had a miscarriage before we had our first, and then we did IVF, and our second one is a frozen embryo. And the crazy thing is, these people exist, and I cannot imagine the world without them. Like, they had to exist. They had to be alive. The idea that anyone else could have, a different egg, a different sperm, a different pregnancy, and there would be a different human. And I think about it every day. My brain will not believe it. It's like, no, they were destined. These people were destined to be alive. And I guess that's the really strong thing about a human narrative, is that even though that I know factually any egg could meet any sperm and a different human being would be in the world, I sort of have become a little bit spiritual about it. Like, no, there are people who have to exist, and they will only come when the time is right,
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you're right, but I understand. I don't
think I'm right. It's just so hard to unexist your kids.
It is, but do you remember the point before they're born? You kind of thinking, I wonder what they'll look like, and I wonder what and you can't imagine it. And then the minute they're born, you can't imagine them being anything other than that.
Yeah.
So it is kind of crazy. But I've experienced some of the similar things that what you're talking about there. And it is, you do sometimes think, well, what if that had happened, or what if this had happened? And, and then you wouldn't, if you've had a miscarriage and then you go on to have another child, you probably wouldn't have had the second child.
Yeah.
So, exactly. So that's a really... That's a really hard thing to deal with, but you're glad you've got whatever you've got.
Oh, so, absolutely.
Those things are, but that's, but again, it, the whole birth, you've actually created human beings out of your body. And I've only watched that happen, and that just is so freaky.
But again, I can't, it happens to me, and yet I can't believe it. Like, I don't want to be the mum who's always going like, you used to live inside me. But like Theodore's about to turn two. And I'm just astonished. I'm trying to remember, like, I definitely, like, felt him kick. Like, he was definitely in there. Because I had C-sections, you see. So they put up a little sort of windbreak, and you can't see what's happening. And then a baby appears, and you can't feel anything. So it could all be made up. It could be. Okay. Yeah, it could just be they just sort of, you know, crack one out of an egg.
Yeah, bring it up. I've seen them coming out, and it looks like bad animatronics as well. So I'm really behind you on that. I think they could easily, when Phoebe came out, what I first saw was like a head the size of an adult head coming out. And then everything sort of went, and then it was a kid again. But like my brain couldn't even process what I was saying. So maybe they got the CGI wrong for a second.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? There's something that's so quotidian. It's how every single person comes into the world. Yet our brain cannot absorb it as truth. It keeps going, does it make more sense that was, I was on a hallucinogen?
But yeah, it's, well, you know, this book will make you think about all of these things. Hopefully not so much that you go over the edge. but I think it makes you think and makes you more comfortable with the sane part of yourself to embrace. I know when you call it insane, it's the fanciful kind of and sometimes ridiculous part of your brain.
I think I hope that even if someone doesn't enjoy Sophie's journey, they're like, I'm glad I'm not Sophie. But I've had messages that made me so happy from people who really liked her because they felt a kinship with her and a similarity. I had one woman who wrote to me and said she wasn't going to let her husband read the book because she felt so aligned with Sophie that if he had any criticisms of her, she would have to leave him. and I had one the other day from someone actually who has psychosis, and they said, I, not knowing what your book was about, I started it and it was really difficult in terms of the voices in her head, because while she doesn't have psychosis, there's a similarity. Yeah. But she'd felt compelled to finish the book, even though it was a struggle for her and her own inner monologue. And that felt like, to me, like, okay, I definitely hit on something that's true for lots of people. Yeah. Because at points, it's agitating. It's if someone's struggling with their own ones at the same time as then getting sofas, it's a lot. Yeah.
For sure. And, you know, I would say she's not likable, but you're still invested in her journey. I mean, and saying she's not likable isn't right either. I liked her. She's, because we're seeing everything about her, I was willing her on to get away from herself and to, you know, or to actually be comfortable with herself. And she sort of does both of those things, I suppose, in the end. There's no way you can make this person, you know, because it's a warts and all thing, because it literally is everything she thinks. There's no way, if you wrote a character that was not, that we were absolutely loving and rooting for, this book would not work, because that's nobody's head, you know.
And I think that's where, because I love reading so much, but I really am irritated sometimes when things are a bit too positive, because I think, well, come on, you know, no one's mum is that decent, and no vicar is that impure. I want things to investigate humanity properly, to, and, you know, lift up the rock a little bit. And especially if you're going inside someone's mind, it's going to be messy in there. It's going to be messy.
And I would just say, like, I'm writing, you're reading a lot of books. I know you do anyway. And I'm reading a lot of books for this podcast. But this one is one that, like, some of them I like, enjoy, and then don't remember anything about. And some of them, you know, I don't enjoy as much. But usually the books in this book club I do enjoy, because that's why I'm choosing them. But some of the ones I don't put in, I haven't liked necessarily. But this one really stays with you. And also, as you're reading it, it is occupying your thoughts. In a really great way. So I think it is, you know, it is in that sort of catcher in the rye territory where you get invested in something and get invested in a weirdo character. But it makes you think about yourself as well. So I very much recommend it. Are you working on, I hope you're not, because I hope you're not working too hard, but are you planning another novel to follow this?
Yeah. Yes. I'm writing the notes on it.
Okay.
And it's about the relationship between a woman and her nanny, her au pair. So it's much more in terms of experience. It's not autobiographical, but it's much more in my world now.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. That sounds great. And I know you do your own book podcast with Carrie.
Yes, you must come on. You must come on. Especially if there's a book that you've read that you don't want to do on your podcast. Tell us, and we'll come and do it on ours.
Okay. Yeah. There are a few. So that would be good. Yes, I'd love to. Is there any books that you would like to recommend? Is there a book you haven't recommended on your podcast that you'd like to recommend? But you can be one you've been on your podcast.
Well, actually, this is quite a short one. I know lots of people struggle with time to read, and they're envious. They're like, "Where do you get the time?" You know, so there's an amazing book by Gwendolyn Riley. Yeah, My Phantoms. That's the book. I read it after I just submitted my book, and it wasn't one of those books that made me wish I hadn't written mine, but it was one where I was like, I'm glad I didn't read this while I was writing, because it would have influenced me too much. But her conversations with both of her parents, I've never read anything that encapsulates why parents are so annoying and so complicated, and why someone else could be sitting next to you going, why does that bother you so much? Why does that expression, why is the way they've spoken to the waiter upset you like this? And the ending of it is, and I think this is what we want from art, it's like being punched. It's like being punched in the solar plexus, all within a very, very sort of, you know, truthful, gritty realism story. And it's short, so people won't be going like, oh my God. It's like you look at it and go, yeah, I can do that. I can read that in a couple of baths. It's really fantastic.
Okay, great. That sounds fantastic. I will check that out myself. Lovely to see you, as always, Sarah.
Lovely to see
and
you.
Really congratulations on the book, which is coming out in paperback.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when this is going.
April 25th.
Yeah. So do check it out. And obviously there's a fantastic audiobook which Sarah reads beautifully as well.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Chris Evans and Ben Evans for all their hard work behind the scenes. And we'll see you again next week. Thank you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.